is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington. Here is what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
The aim is to provide a cleaner and more affordable alternative to gasoline by boosting the use of domestic natural gas.
That's Timothy Obiezu reporting from Abuja. Details coming up. Also, Ethiopian forces and militias killed Sudanese troops in a cross-border attack. And Nigeria reopens its borders with Benin and Niger, which it closed a year ago. All these and more ahead on Africa News Tonight. But first, our top story. Nigerian authorities say they have surrounded the hideout of militants who last week abducted over 300 schoolboys in the country's northwest, and a teacher is negotiating for their release. Security operatives say they are refraining from launching an attack into the forest area to avoid injuring the boys. Katsina State Governor Aminu Bello Masari on Wednesday said, although the kidnappers have not made concrete demands, they have welcomed negotiations with the teacher. This week, many states in northern Nigeria, including Kaduna, Kano, Jigawa, and Zamfara, shut down schools over fear of attacks. Northern Nigeria has experienced more than a decade of militant violence, chiefly from the Islamist group Boko Haram. Boko Haram has attacked several schools and villages and is responsible for thousands of deaths and hundreds of kidnappings. Nigeria's government has announced a natural gas expansion program to urge vehicle owners to convert their gasoline engines to run on the cheaper and cleaner burning natural gas. As Timothy Obiezu reports from Abuja, the initiative also aims to reduce Nigeria's dependence on oil.
There was cheering at the launch in Abuja when Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari officially unveiled the natural gas expansion program this month. Authorities said they're targeting 1 million vehicles for free conversion during an initial phase from December to the end of 2021. Yusuf Lawal represented Nigeria's Association of Road Transport Owners at the launch and said the aim is to provide a cleaner and more affordable alternative to gasoline by boosting the use of domestic natural gas.
We believe that a lot of the operational cost hitherto is by diesel, and the PMS will be reduced to a barest minimum. Of course, at the beginning, we will experience some hiccups in terms of familiarity with the tanks, the usage, and the installation of the devices to make it compliant. But in the long run, of course, we are going to enjoy it.
Nigeria ranks 9th in the world with over 200 trillion cubic feet of natural gas reserves, but those reserves are largely underutilized for many years. The country has survived largely on earnings from trading its crude oil, which accounts for about 90% of its foreign revenue. But with the coronavirus pandemic, global oil prices dropped, and so did Nigeria's earnings, prompting the country to end government-sponsored fuel subsidy programs, sparking protests nationwide. Officials say tapping into its natural gas reserves will help Nigeria become less dependent on oil, diversify its economy, and create 2 million jobs. Timi Pres Silva is Nigeria's Minister for Petroleum Resources.
This administration is dedicated to implementing programs that are focused on improving the life of its citizens, creating jobs, building indigenous technical expertise, and stimulating other sectors of the economy to address unemployment amongst our youth.
For now, only designated agencies will be carrying out the conversion of vehicles. That's why car mechanics like Adamu Mande say the plan could cause them to lose their day jobs unless they upgrade their skills.
If federal government can make it to be available for every technician, or to open a forum or a lecture room whereby some of us can go there to learn, before we can be able to go on with this, it will be okay for us.
Even though the conversion process is easily reversible and offers vehicle users the ability to interchange petrol or gas engines at will, converting engines to use natural gas is seen as one way to cut down on carbon emissions, a goal many countries around the world, including Nigeria, seek to promote. Timothy Obiezu for VOA News, Abuja.
Nigeria has decided to reopen its borders with neighboring Benin and Niger about a year after they were closed. The Nigerian government closed the borders to crack down on the smuggling of rice, arms, and other commodities. According to the French news agency AFP, President Muhammadu Buhari stunned Nigeria's neighbors, Benin and Niger, when he unexpectedly closed the country's borders last year to goods and trade, saying the time had come to crush contraband trade. Critics of Buhari's unilateral move said it violated commercial and freedom of movement treaties signed under the Economic Community of West African States, ECOWAS. The closure had a major impact on Benin, a key exporter of food to Nigeria. It also affected border communities in Nigeria and was blamed for inflated prices for staples in domestic markets. The government of Zimbabwe is poised to implement a measure to allow the seizure and forfeiture of what it calls unexplained wealth, as it claims the country is losing hundreds of millions of dollars through corruption. Harigando gives us more on the story.
In the recent budget statement, Finance Minister Mthuli Ncube announced that his government would soon implement an unexplained wealth orders measure to combat corruption, which he says robs the country of US$1 billion annually. The minister said the government will bolster funds for law enforcement agencies that pursue corruption in both the private and public sectors. In his budget statement, the minister allocated 3.6 billion Zimbabwe RTGS dollars for this effort. Some analysts, however, say the amount is not enough to effectively combat corruption. Legal experts and economists question whether the government has the capacity to pursue offenders, the political will to follow through, and the impartiality that they say is necessary for the anti-corruption measure to yield the intended result. Economist Gift Mugano says the country's losses through corruption are far more than the official figures.
Losing more than $1 billion. If you look at the tonnage which we've had, which we are losing in gold, any measure aimed at dealing with corruption is this welcome. Anything pointing towards tearing corrupt people is good. The challenge in Zimbabwe is implementation. There are a number of units which deals with corruption. We have enough instruments already on the ground which can deal with corruption, but nothing has been done. And the reason is why there's no political will. That's the answer. You can set up many institutions, you can have a number of legislative reforms. As long as there's no political will, there's not going to be any success in dealing with corruption.
Mugano cites the example of two government ministers who have been fired over corruption in the past year without the seizure of their assets. Observers such as Mugano say the anti-corruption drive is noble but fraught with political interference and easily abused. Economic analyst Prosper Chitambara describes the new measure as being in line with international best practice.
My take is that this is really one effective way of fighting and tackling corruption. And this move is also in line with regional and international best practice. And if it is fully operationalized and implemented, it should result in the country recovering quite significant amounts that had been stolen through corruption.
Legal expert and legislator Kutaka Pulu says the finance minister's plan appears to be based on the Money Laundering and Proceeds of Crime Act enacted in 2018, which contains some vague clauses.
It's a necessary law, though, but it's a certain abuse, and it really should be a law to target high profile, or rather high end people with lots and lots of wealth. And I think the distinction between those who have wealth which is unexplained and ordinary people who have something valuable is not made in that act. There's a history of selective application of the law, especially when it comes to the political arena. It is the ordinary people who may suffer from persecution as a result of that act, and not necessarily the corrupt mogas who will suffer from it.
Pulum Ganu and others say Zimbabwe's anti-corruption drive has been hobbled by what appears to be the selective application of the law. They say as long as the partiality persists, the efforts to stem corruption are too weak. Reporting for VOA, this is Adegondo in Bulawayo.
News media report that Sudan is accusing Ethiopian forces and militias of killing Sudanese troops in a cross-border attack. Sudan's military did not say how many troops were killed or wounded in the attack, and there was no immediate comment from Ethiopia. Sudan's Prime Minister, Abdullah Hamdok, visited Ethiopia briefly last Sunday and relayed his concerns about threats to Sudan's security along its border with Tigray. The Associated Press reports that Sudan had deployed more than 6,000 troops to the Ethiopian border at the start of fighting in Ethiopia's Tigray region. The fighting in Ethiopia's northern Tigray region erupted on November 4th. The Ethiopian government said its offensive is aimed at leaders of the Tigray People Liberation Front, which it said had attacked federal military facilities. The TPLF says the offensive is a war against the people of Tigray. Thousands of people are believed to have been killed and more than 950,000 displaced, with about 50,000 fleeing to Sudan, according to the United Nations estimates. There has been widespread backlash in recent days over U.S. President Donald Trump's decision to recognize Morocco's claim of sovereignty over the disputed Western Sahara region, including from senior members of Trump's Republican Party. The Polisario Front, which is the political and military leadership of the self-declared Sahrawi Arab Democratic Republic in Western Sahara, says it rejects Trump's move, standing by its long-standing accusation that Morocco illegally occupies the land. Morocco, which had held the Western Sahara since Spain left in 1975, says it regards the vast desert region as an integral part of its own territory. The United Nations has said the issue should be solved by a referendum of the people of Western Sahara. Now, there are fears that a flare-up of violence in the region last month between Moroccan forces and the Polisario Front could escalate. VOA's Jason Patinkin spoke with Maloud Said, who is the Polisario Front's representative to Washington, D.C., and is currently in Spain.
First of all, this statement that Mr. Trump made, he made a statement without mentioning any legal base for it, any legal argument. He said that Morocco was the first country to, one of the first countries to recognize the United States. Therefore, I'm giving him Western Sahara. I mean, as if Western Sahara is a piece of real estate sitting there with no owners, or if we are a commodity that can be part of an international transaction. So for us, this has no effect, and it does not change the nature of the conflict. As you know, the Sahrawi Republic, Western Sahara, the Sahrawi Republic, is a full-fledged member of the African Union as an independent country, and Morocco is occupying part of that country. So for us, this does not change anything. And it's very important to see the reaction of the internet, not just members of the United States Senate and Congress and different politicians and the press in the United States, but also their reaction internationally. I'm sure you saw the statement by the European Union, by the UK, by Sweden, by the African Union, by the United Nations. All of them, they said that this has no value, has no ground, and nobody is supporting this move, because it's a violation, a flagrant violation of international law. This is taking us back to the law of the jungle. So this is, we believe that's not going to have any effect. It's not going to stop us from fighting with more determination until we put an end to the Moroccan occupation of Western Sahara.
You mentioned Trump's statements that Morocco recognized the United States in 1777. And when Trump announced this, he also said on Twitter, and I quote, "Morocco's serious, credible, and realistic autonomy proposal is the only basis for a just and lasting solution for enduring peace and prosperity," end quote. What is your response to that?
That should be the response of the Sahrawi people, whether it's that the autonomy is the best plan. That should be something acceptable by the Sahrawi people, but it cannot be the substitute of the will of the Sahrawi people. This is the thing that Mr. Trump is trying to substitute the will of the Sahrawi people and impose his own will on the Sahrawis, violating its right to self-determination. So we don't believe that we're in the times of emperors dictating, but we have a law, we have the United Nations, we have the Security Council, and unfortunately, the United States, which is a member of the Security Council, now is just disqualifying itself from playing a role in looking for the real solution to the conflict based on the respect of the right of the people to self-determination. But for him to say that this is the only solution, so he's substituting himself to the will of the Sahrawi people.
Now, there are some concerns that this could lead to an escalation in the disputes. And of course, in November, there were clashes between the two sides, as well as a border incident in October. What is the Polisario Front's stance on whether there might be a return to serious armed conflict in Western Sahara?
It's not a matter that there will be. It's already, since November the 13th, and we made it in a public statement on November 14th, that we disassociate ourselves from the ceasefire that was holding since 1991. The reason is that Morocco, on November 13th, they crossed the buffer zone and in violation of the ceasefire. So right now, there are attacks that we're attacking the Moroccan position.
Now, there's a new presidential administration coming in. President-elect Joe Biden will become president next month. How do you think the Joe Biden administration might approach this?
I can only speak out of my observation of all the years that I have been following President-elect Biden. I know that he was chairman for many, many years, chairman of the International Relations Committee in the Senate. And he's a man who is very much for the multilateral approach to any issue, international issues. And I'm sure he's not going to be following the unilateral approach that Trump has been taking, in particular in the question of Western Sahara. So the only thing I can say that we are very hopeful that the new administration will respect the international law, the international regulations, and the right of self-determination for the Sahrawi people. That's our hope.
That was Mouloud Saeed, the Polisario Front's representative in Washington. He was speaking with my colleague, Jason Patinkin. VOA could not independently verify Saeed's claim of attacks on Moroccan positions. Experts say the vast semi-arid Sahel region separating the Sahara Desert on the north and the tropical savannas on the south has high solar energy potential. But poor infrastructure and funding remain challenges, as Annie Risenberg reports from Mali's capital, Bamako.
This week, the African Development Bank hosted the African Energy Marketplace, AEMP, an annual forum focused on the energy sector. This year, the event was held virtually. The theme was the solar energy potential of the G5 Sahel countries, Burkina Faso, Chad, Mali, Mauritania, and Niger. Maman Sambou Sidiku, executive secretary of the G5 Sahel, speaking in Abuja, said the countries are not exploiting solar energy as they should. He says, while our region has one of the highest potentials in the world, we are not taking advantage. He says, with a cumulative gross domestic product close to $53 billion and a large part of its territory benefiting from stable and consistent sunshine, the G5 Sahel is the ideal region to demonstrate the power of solar energy. Installing solar energy requires not just solar panels, but batteries, inverters, and power regulators. Maintaining and repairing the network requires the knowledge of skilled technicians. This is a challenge in the Sahel, where infrastructure is lacking. Gregoire Galli manages the Green Business Area Program at GERDES, a non-governmental organization working to battle climate change and global warming. He says, we've observed that there are a lot of solar energy products that have been distributed in the past few years, but the quality is not always there. And sometimes it's the installation that is not always well done, he says. It is nevertheless a technology that is of great interest, but that remains a little complex and with certain specificities. The electricians have not always been trained in these techniques. Access to the necessary materials can also be difficult, particularly in rural areas. In addition, solar energy is not widely used, and the upfront costs keep solar energy financially inaccessible to most of the population. Galli says it's true that looked at as an investment for 25 years or 50 years, it's less expensive. But today in the Sahel, he says, the reality is that for an individual, a household, or a small business, even if it's less expensive in 25 years, the initial investment is more expensive. Yannick Kemeyou, the founder of Kabaku Academies, a learning space in Bamako, Mali, knows firsthand the benefits of solar energy. The building that is home to Kabaku was intentionally built in one of Bamako's poor, dense neighborhoods in order to be accessible to all of the population. But in poor neighborhoods, as Kemeyou explained, power outages are even more frequent than elsewhere. Kabaku Academies is now 100% powered by solar power.
When we started Kabaku, we were actually on the grid, but we realized that we had productivity losses of up to 70% in the rainy season because like 6 to 7 out of 10 scheduled activities, scheduled workshops, boot camps will have to be canceled because of power outages.
Electric power outages are a major problem in all of the G5 Sahel countries. However, for those with the means to pay for solutions, solar power is not yet widely accepted as a viable solution to frequent power cuts. Many prefer to buy generators, which, like investments in solar energy, are costly.
Why are people nowadays in Bamako or in Mali still buying generators? This is a big question, and I have to admit I don't have the answers, and I will love to have the answers, because it seems that population or the people here, they will know that solar energy exists.
Aside from the challenges inherent in establishing a network of solar energy, most of the countries that make up the G5 Sahel have also been struggling with an ongoing Islamist insurgency. Mali is facing political instability. Former President Ibrahim Boubacar Keita was ousted in an August coup. This year's AEMP focus on the Sahel was in the context of the African Development Bank's Desert to Power initiative. The program's goal is to develop 10 gigawatts of solar energy and supply 250 million people with green, clean electricity by 2025. Annie Reisenberg for VOA News, Bamako, Mali.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehiyas Muhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokibidi Abaro, thank you again for tuning in and choosing The Voice of America.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of Press Conference USA, VOA's newsmaker interview program. Join us each Saturday and Sunday when we talk with authors, analysts, and policymakers who provide fresh insight on topics ranging from U.S. politics and foreign policy to science, culture, and global health. You can listen to Press Conference USA on the radio or online at voanews.com/PCUSA. While you're visiting our website, be sure to subscribe to our podcast. We'd also love to hear from you. Just send an email to pcusa@voanews.com or connect with us on Facebook at facebook.com/CarolCastielVOA or on Twitter at CarolCastielVOA. That's Press Conference USA every Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
VOA brings you the best in African music on the African beat. African Beat showcases the latest and the greatest of contemporary African music, from bobo music to hip life, bongo flavor to soukous, Afrobeat to ndombolo and makossa to kwaito. The African Beat on VOA has it all. And it's happening right here, Mondays through Fridays at 09:05 and 20:05 UTC, right after the international news.
The Voice of America's Global News Program, International Edition, brings you an in-depth look at the biggest news stories of the day. Nobody covers the world more comprehensively than VOA. Our correspondents gather the news and the views of the most seasoned experts on international issues. Tune in Monday through Friday at 3:30 and 17:05 UTC on The Voice of America.